Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us in this episode today is Dr. Rosa Omuratek and his new book, The Zen Buddhist Philosophy of D.T. Suzuki, Strengths, Foibles, Intrigues, and Precision. It was recently published through Bloomsbury as a part of the Bloomsbury Introductions to World Philosophy series. Rosa is a scholar of philosophy and translation studies at the Aichi Prefectural University in Japan. This book contains a brief introduction to D.T. Suzuki, who is a philosopher from pre-war Japan who had a profound influence in the spreading of Zen Buddhism worldwide. Rosa also introduces some of Suzuki's key ideas, as well as the English translation for two of Suzuki's works. Welcome, Rosa. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So D.T. Suzuki is such an interesting figure. He's written so much about the aesthetics of Japanese culture, the ideals of Japanese beauty, and of course, Zen Buddhism. So how did you get into the study of D.T. Suzuki?
Well, the first time I came across D.T. Suzuki, it wasn't really in connection with my studies or whatever. I was an undergraduate student, and like many, many years ago, like a lot of undergraduate students, I was always kind of excited by any kind of edgy, radical alternative ideas I came across. And a friend of mine, John Walsh, he came across a bunch of Zen books, D.T. Suzuki Zen books, and when I started reading it, I was quite fascinated by it. Is kind of very alternative, unexpected ideas. Now, I read that in conjunction with an awful lot of other ideas I was excited about at the time. Even though it was interesting, it was kind of like reading about the Spanish Civil War. It was something far away that was exciting, romantic, but adventurous, but, you know, had little to do with me. So that came and went, that first contact with D.T. Suzuki. I went to Japan. I started doing Japanese studies, went to Japan. Kind of knew then that D.T. Suzuki, his descriptions of Zen is not fully connected with what modern Zen might be really, what modern Japan might be really like. But I was still kind of always, he was always there at the back of my mind as the kind of the first Japanese philosopher I'd ever encountered. Later when I went back into postgraduate work, I was doing kind of translation theory, the philosophy of translation. I felt that D.T. Suzuki might be a good case study of the actual translation of philosophy and history, how Zen and Buddhism and all that was translated into English. So I kind of used him for my dissertation on the philosophy of translation. I have to say, as well as that, as well as being a good case study for translation theory, just reading D.T. Suzuki over the years was a huge education for me, because he was such a wide area was so wide ranging, and he was so prolific that for me it was a great education in not only Zen but Buddhism, Asian religions, Asian history, Asian philosophy. Even Suzuki himself was so connected to early 20th century other intellectuals like From, Jung as well. It kind of, you know, he touches on them as well. So just for him, he's been a huge teacher for me. You know, like any teacher, of course, I have my doubts about arguments about certain things, but definitely, you know, reading him has been a huge, massive education for me.
Fascinating. Now I guess I'll jump to the obvious question. Who is D.T. Suzuki, and what did he do that made him so famous and influential?
Okay, so D.T. Suzuki, his dates are 1870 to 1966. So he lived quite a long time and wrote throughout most of his life. So he spans a huge chunk of the 20th century, starting off from late 19th century Japan. What makes him so influential in you know, history or the history of ideas is basically he wrote about Zen in English. That kickstarts it all. Now, people write about other religions all the time, okay? But his writings in Zen were so rhetorically powerful. He presented Zen as this kind of not just one more religion, but the kind of the basic principle of all religions, that it presents a certain knowledge, understanding of the world that, you know, nobody who's grown up within the Western traditions of philosophy will be able to understand it, that it presents a whole new vision of life, of the world, of selfhood. He wrote all this and used an awful lot of Zen stories, Zen koans, and you know, Japanese and Chinese literature that it just fascinated an awful lot of people, you know, an awful lot of Western intellectuals. And for a while, Suzuki would have been, for the West, for the intelligentsia of the West, kind of Asia's foremost philosopher. If you wanted to read something about Asian philosophy, he was the guy you would go to. Okay, he's the book you would take down off the library. Now he doesn't have that status now, but for many decades he did, and not just among the you know, intellectuals. Also, towards the 50s, there was what was called the Zen boom, where Zen actually became quite fashionable in America. Okay, like there's a whole, I think it's Cosmopolitan magazine has a whole spread about D.T. Suzuki, okay, and his new Zen fashion that you know, became quite popular, you know. But not only did he write about Zen, what's less known about him is that he also wrote about other sects of Buddhism, like Jodo, Huayan, Kegon, And also wrote quite a lot about you know, Asian philosophy in general. He was also a great translator. He learned Sanskrit and translated Sanskrit sutras into Japanese and English. And he wrote an awful lot of columns for Japanese newspapers. Okay, so very prolific, very influential, a great network who seemed to know everybody. Okay, all the big top names of Western philosophy and psychoanalysis, you know, Eric Fromm, even Heidegger knew of him and met him. Even within Japan, his high school buddy was Nishida Kitaro, and he had a big impact on the Kyoto school. So just through his works and through his networking, he's been hugely influential in, you know, Asian philosophy in general.
That is very interesting, and it always amazes me how influential Zen Buddhism is, or how many people conceive it as the representative aspect of Japanese culture. Even nowadays, we would have students coming to classes of Japanese civilization or Japanese religion, and when we ask them, why did you want to learn about Japan, they say, oh, because I'm interested in Zen Buddhism. Actually, they don't say Buddhism. They just say Zen. So that's always an amazing part. But we'll come back to this point later.
Yes, yeah.
But
yeah.
In your book, in introducing his philosophical ideas, you divide them into self, knowledge, and world. How does his philosophy center around these themes?
Yes. Well, actually, the reason why I've divided it into self, knowledge, and world came from one of the editors, Takeshi Morisato. It's thanks to him I was able to write this book. He suggested it to me, and he kind of said, either he said you can or you're meant to divide into self, knowledge, world. And for a while, I'd been trying to write a book about Suzuki, but because he's so his philosophy is so broad and scattered, I couldn't really get it together into a system. And when Takeshi suggested a self-knowledge world, and I started to think about it, suddenly it was like a jigsaw, all the pieces fitted together. And I could see there is a certain system behind Suzuki's philosophy. And it all connects in the sense of you can start with either self or knowledge or world. But if you start with self, like I do in my book, you can see that selfhood concludes a non-selfhood. Okay, we don't have an essentialized self. Okay, we exist in a here and now that can't be connected with the cause effect chain of the rest of the world. Okay, so we've no selfhood as such. And if you if you know the world through your non-selfhood rather than the everyday knowledge where you're looking out on the world, but where you're so infused with the world. That is a certain type of knowledge. It's the most profound knowledge because it's knowledge that you don't find. It's you know it without trying to know it. You know it so much that you can't not know it. Okay, you exist here and now. You can't not know that. Okay, and this has implications for our vision of the world. It leads to a kind of a non-dualistic vision of the world where we do maybe experience the world in kind of I'm there and the object's over there, but really the more we penetrate into it, there's this huge non-dualistic oneness to the world, okay? So you can describe his system by starting from any of those points. Describe the world, you get to this non-dualistic knowledge, you get to this notion of selfhood, or you can go the other way. But either way, the world connect and do conclude in each, the one an inquiry into one, what is knowledge, what is self, what is the world, will lead to a conclusion of the other. Okay.
Fascinating. In a recent, very recent interview that I just did with Takeshi Morisato on his new book on Tanabe Hajime and the Kyoto School, he also talks about this issue of self and no self in Tanabe Hajime's philosophy. Would you say Tanabe's philosophy and D.T. Suzuki's, their understanding of this no selfhood are along the same lines? Do they kind of draw from similar inspirations, or how do they differ?
Okay, that's an interesting question because actually Nishitani, another Kyoto School philosopher, talks about having discussions and arguments with Tanabe, where Tanabe was quite irritated by Suzuki's dismissal of philosophy. Tanabe had written a book about Dogen and Suzuki kind of said, "Oh, that's too much philosophy," and Tanabe didn't like that. So there was unusually for all the other Kyoto philosophers, kind of saw Suzuki as a bit of a hero, but I think Hajime was a bit of an exception there. Okay, okay. There was Kyoto School's a wide range. There was Tosaka Jun probably didn't like him either. Yes, they would have drawn from the same inspiration. They were kind of Buddhist modernizers. I think Tanabe was always a bit uneasy with the idea of getting so much into non-selfhood, so much into the non-duality that you are there in the here and now, of course, but you're missing out everything else. You're missing out on the history that leads up to your being in the here and now. You're leaving out in the the narrative of human life, okay, that you do need the duality to be able to talk about and describe and experience and know you're experiencing the world. And when you kind of abstract it all the way back to, into this kind of pre-subject-object pure experience, you know, you've left out meaning. You've left out history, okay? And how do you get that back in? I think that would have been Tanabe's problem with Suzuki, perhaps.
Fascinating. I'll have to pretend that I understood all of that. But for our listeners, if anyone's interested in the Kyoto School, you can check out this recent episode with Dr. Takeshi Morisato, also on the Japanese Studies channel. But returning to your book, Rozev, so one interesting thing that you mentioned is how he was influenced by European ideas around his time, but then developed his own philosophy that invited criticism on him later. So what happened? What kind of European ideas influenced his philosophy? How did he develop his own ideas? And why is he sometimes criticized so harshly?
Okay, well, two big influences on Suzuki, the early Suzuki, the young Suzuki, and when he was coming of age in the 1880s, 1890s, was Shaku Soen and Paul Karus. Shaku Soen was a abbot of the temple where he first learned his Zen. And Shaku Soen attended the World Parliament of Religions, a big gathering of religions, okay, that was held in the Chicago area. I think it was held in Chicago, Illinois, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. And when Shaku Soen was there, he met a American-German philosopher called Paul Karus, okay, who had his own system of philosophy called monism. And when the two of them sat down together, Shaku Soen and Paul Karus, they immediately could see kind of huge overlaps and connections between Buddhism and various different strands of Western philosophy. I'd like to say that, you know, years ago I would have been a bit cynical about their understandings of both Asian and Western philosophy, you know, that we're kind of trained to assume that everything 19th century Westerners had to say about Asian philosophy must have been wrong, you know, must have been full of, you know, post-colonial distortions, whatever. As I get older, I see, no, I think these guys, their instincts were correct, you know? You know, I think us humans, we all have the same range of problems, and we're always going to come up with the same kind of ideas about them. And I think when Shaku and Karus sat down, you know, it was natural that they would find common ground, okay? Anyway, so Suzuki went off, was Shakuen's kind of disciple, be too strong word, but he studied on, well, meditated under Shakuen, and he went to work for Paul Karus in Illinois. They lived in a town called La Salle, I think, and he worked for him in a publishing press that a publishing company that Paul Karus managed, okay, called Open Court. It's still in existence to publish philosophy books, and he learned his trade there. But you know how to produce journals, how to produce books. You know, he translated various stuff, and I think you know, Paul Karus, how much did he influence Suzuki is debatable, but definitely picked up on this idea of kind of Buddhism having an overlap with various Western traditions. For example, at the time, pragmatism, William James was kind of in the air. Okay, his idea of religion, we should look at religion as a experience, as a scientist would look at any experience. Okay, we will look at religion. Even the ideas of psychology, psychoanalysis that were coming to the fore. Later on, existentialism would have interested Suzuki to some extent. He tended to see, even though the West was getting at certain Buddhist ideas through psychoanalysis, existentialism, and so on, he tended to see that this was the West trying to catch up with the East, okay? That the East had the answers, okay? The East worked that all that one out centuries ago, okay? And his job is just to simply describe the solutions Zen had come up with, rather than to, you know, engage in the, you know, the kind of the the discoveries of philosophy. Now, criticisms. There have been a lot of criticisms of Suzuki, mild criticism and harsh criticisms. And I'm going to categorize them a bit. Okay, the mild criticisms, first of all, would be people who read Suzuki and then signed up to the Zen religion, let's say. Okay, people like Philip Kaplow or whatever. And when they get to their Zen temples, to find that it's an awful lot of meditation and rigorous lifestyle and not the crazy world of the koans, okay? So that's kind of a mild criticism, just that he might have romanticized it a bit. Another mild criticism is that anytime Suzuki is discussing the history of Zen, he tended to just presented the mythologies as real history, okay? And people have said, no, you have to look at, how temples created the texts of koan and how certain masters were emphasized over other masters to support certain lines and sects of Zen. Okay, that's a mild criticism. The more harsh criticism, okay, the big one that kind of probably has shook his reputation a bit was a book by Brian Victoria, Zen at War, where it accuses Suzuki to some extent of being complicit in the war or saying things that sounded a bit pro-militarism. It's a very complicated area, and I could be all day talking about it. My opinion would be that Suzuki wrote an awful lot, okay? And if he was really pro-militarism, it would be very obvious. It wouldn't be just random quotes, random nuggets. He would have come out explicitly saying it. For every quote you can say where he seems slightly pro-war, there's quotes where he's anti-war. He also spoke out against state Shintoism at a time when it wouldn't have been profitable for him to do so. I think people are disappointed that he wasn't more anti-war, and that's fair enough. Okay, it's particularly if like Victoria, you've signed up to the Zen religion, that you're entitled to your disappointments. Rather than saying, Suzuki, we all think he was a nice guy, and he, when Japan went to war, he did nothing, therefore he's not a nice guy. I don't think that's the way to see it. I think Suzuki was instinctively a nice person, okay, instinctively a good human. Japan went to war, he was quite passive, about it. He didn't really react that much. Rather than saying a lot about Suzuki, I think that says a lot about how people react to a society that goes to war, and when that war takes a few decades to emerge, okay? So if you think about it, Suzuki was born in 1870. Okay, by 1945, Japan had obviously gone very wicked, very totalitarian, okay? It's very hard to know at what point you would have known when Japan had kind of gone to the dark side, had become fairly militaristic, okay? In the 1890s, Japan won a war against China that was considered by the standards at the time quite respectable. It's won a war against Russia that people said, Westerners said, oh, Japan is a developed country now. It's a civilized country. It bet Russia in a war. Japan had its empire, Korea, Taiwan, which was a mark of respect for a country. Nowadays, we don't see it that way, but people did in those days. Japan sat at the Treaty of Versailles table as an allied victorious nation, got Saipan as a gift because Germany couldn't be trusted with Saipan, okay, and so on. By 1925, Japan was a more or less a democracy, probably the only democracy in Asia. So, okay, you can talk about, that when the League of Nations starts condemning Japan, that should have been a marker, and when there was various attempted coup d'etats. But still, it's quite hard. You can understand why somebody could come of age, live all through those decades, and not spot it, not notice it, okay? that his society was you know going down the wrong way, you know. So I think it's hard for us to judge, okay, as people who didn't experience it, okay? Okay. Now, I'm not justifying anything. I have my own opinions about World War II and Millerism, but it's nothing to do with me, okay? But I'm just saying, let's be fair to Suzuki, okay? Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay, yes. And then, okay, another related criticism is, like, you'd see this with the philosopher Slavoj Žižek. It's okay, he wasn't a militarist, fair enough, but look at what he said. He said things like about the samurai uses the sword and chops off the head, and it doesn't matter. It's the sword that does the chopping off the head, you know, does the chopping. And he said one quote he had is that Zen can be wedded to the democracy, fascism, communism, anarchism. He used the verb wedded, but I think what he meant was Zen is apolitical, okay? If you're living under Mussolini, you can do Zen just like you can do gardening or yoga or play golf, okay? Now, the problem is, okay, if Zen is like that, well, grand, fine, but what use is Zen, okay? What use is Zen knowledge? Because it contradicts where Suzuki was promoting Zen as something that's quite ethical that we have to learn from, okay? Which is it? Is it something we have to learn? If it is, then you need to, you know, go look at what you said about the samurai. If it's not, well, fine, okay? Okay. Okay, so that's in the harsh category. Another harsh one in the harsh category were recent scholars like Bernard Farr and Robert Scharf, who would have accused Suzuki of constructing Zen. That Zen is this, you know, it's a religion that exists in temples where people meditate, and what Suzuki was doing was inventing a Zen. I'm not sure if I would agree with that, because I think, you know, you can't divide between a authentic religion and an inauthentic religion. Not if you're a secular scholar, okay? Okay, you can't say that's the real Zen, that's not the real Zen. Okay, as academics, we're not entitled to do that. It's a sectarian vision, okay? And I think he was just describing Zen the way somebody from his period would describe Zen, okay? So I would defend them that way. Where then the other attack people would make on Suzuki, and here is where I would join in, okay, is his Orientalism, okay, his obsessional Orientalism, just the way he divides it into East, the world into East and West. Like, first of all, that's a problem, I think. You know, the world, if you can divide the world into East and West, you really don't know a lot about the world, okay? Which is strange, because he was so well-read, so well-traveled, okay? But if you think all the countries of the world, all the societies, all the histories can be divided into, you know, I think you need to read a few more History of the World books, okay? But it wasn't just that he divides it into two, okay? It's that he had this notion that Westerners are those who divide the world into subject and object, and Easterners are those who transcend subject and object, okay? First of all, that's a weird thing to say about Westerners, okay? That I can't visualize how anybody could go around the world constantly dividing themselves into subject and objects, okay? That'd be a psychotic breakdown, okay? Okay, but also, if you look at what he says about Zen elsewhere, okay, and when he uses Linzai is the great ancient Chinese philosopher of Zen. The way Linzai describes it, and Suzuki agrees with him and quotes Linzai, is that subject, object, no subject, no object, one subject and no object, these are kind of four different states of mind that we tend to come in and out of, okay? And it's not dependent on your nationality. It's dependent on your state of mind, whether you're seeing the world as objects where subject and objects have disappeared for you, you know. And when Suzuki describes Westerners as the people who divide the world in subject and object, and Easterners people who transcend subject and object, he's misunderstanding his own interpretation of Linzai. Okay, so I think that's his biggest failing for me, anyway, is the Orientalism, and connected to that also his romanticization of Japan, which hooked Zen to Japan to such an extent that, again, he missed his own point that if Zen is the spirit of all religion, Zen is about being in the here and now. I don't think you can talk so much about, you know, Zen is everywhere, the spirit of everything. Oh, and by the way, it's only in Japan. Okay, that's an obvious contradiction, you know? Okay.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you saying that, because it's actually something that I've been thinking about for my own research project, which is D.T. Suzuki and actually his generation of philosopher or intellectuals' roles in the promotion in the promotion of this so-called unique Japanese aesthetics, which very much based off, a lot of Okakura Tenshin and, of course, Suzuki's ideas about the embracement of nature, appreciation of detail and things as such. So how would you view, if I could slip in my very personal interest question, how would you characterize Suzuki's role in this establishment of the so-called Japanese aesthetics theories?
I presume he's was quite influential in it. A lot of his target audience was the West. Like, for example, his book Zen in Japanese Culture was written in English for English readers, and as Zen's or Suzuki scholars Stefan Grace points out, was part of a kind of a soft power campaign by the Japanese government at the time to kind of, you know, say, well, our, you know, some writing is not as, you know, barbaric as it might seem. So definitely for the West for a long time, the Japanese art and so on would have been seen through the prism of this notion of Zen, okay, of the artist disappearing into the works of art and so on. And I think the thing about Suzuki, his impact in, he always had a rebounded impact on Japan, where the more he became influential in the West, he was making his name in Japan on the basis that, you know, the Westerners thought he was so fascinating. So I think, you know, a lot of how he just tried to describe Japan to the West came back to Japan and became Japan's own description of itself. There's actually, was recently a book by Yamada Shoji, okay, a Japanese scholar who's looked at Suzuki and describes that a lot. Like, he describes that Zen garden in Kyoto, Yuan, isn't it? And just he charts how it went from being just a regular Zen garden to suddenly being part of this, you know, huge Zen vision and experience, and linking it a lot to Suzuki. Okay, the book in English is called Shots in the Dark by Yamada Shoji. Sorry.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting. I would like to ask more about that, but I guess we should return to the book. So you included translations of two of his essays, The Place of Peace in Our Heart and Religion and Science. So why did you choose these two in particular? And I guess as a scholar of translation studies, what kind of process was it like to translate such a philosophical yet, as you said, Orientalist person's work?
Okay, yeah. Well, first of all, I actually had difficulty finding texts that were suitable because I found this, because it's about philosophy, I found this text about Zen to Tetsugaku, Zen and philosophy, and I spent ages translating it into English. And then I discovered, to my shock and horror, it had been originally written in English. And I've been translating the his own Japanese version of it. Okay. And then another one, I was about to embark on another translation of a section of a book, and I discovered it had already been translated by Mr. Stefan Grace, actually. So, but eventually I found these two texts, and what I was happy with was one is from the early Suzuki and one is from the late Suzuki, and it shows a huge consistency in his thinking. Yeah, the process of translation, the early one was very difficult, okay, because pre-World War II, Japanese tends to use an awful lot of kanji, even you know, often Chinese grammatical structures almost, okay, at least in the written terms of the written characters. It's very distant from the Japanese I'd be learning and hearing and experiencing every day here. But I did enjoy it, and you know, I think that the point I've always made in my philosophy of translation is that the translator is, in particularly in intellectual work, the translator is the interpreter. Okay, and I have to accept that I'm cursed with that freedom. Okay, that there's no big dictionary out there that's going to tell me exactly how to translate that particular term. It's up to me. I'm the book literally stops with me. Okay, so I've over the years learned that as a translator, you do have that freedom, and don't be scared about it. Don't be guilty about it. Okay, don't feel guilty that, oh, I've no right to translate this way. No, nobody else is going to translate it. You know, what I mean is, you're as good as any other translator, okay? And it's up to you. It's your choice. So, you know, I went at it that way, you know? You know, and there's always lovely conundrums, like, you know, Zen in Japanese anyway would have certain lovely phrases, okay, that can be written in four characters or you know, certain kind of little metaphors, whatever. So, you know, I relegated some of them to footnotes to try and, you know, keep them in, you know.
Amazing. And from these works, how do you view the relationships among religion, philosophy, and science in Suzuki's philosophy? So one of the essays, Religion, Science, right? He kind of talks about this. But what's the historical and social context that may have contributed to his views of these relationships among, you know, religion, science, philosophy?
Right. Yes. Well. Suzuki, from very early on, like what I've translated, Place of Peace in the Heart is actually one of his first works. Okay, and he was always fascinated about this question of the relationship between religion, philosophy, and science, because it was assumed by a lot of people that one would knock out the other. Okay. Usually science. The assumption would eventually be all just science. That's all we will know. Even philosophy will be kicked out. You know, some people have had that expectation even now. He saw religion and philosophy and science as all compatible with each other. If there's a conflict between them, that's because there's a misunderstanding. He felt that they all equally validly, not equally, but they all validly describe the same world. Okay. And they all have their own part to play in giving us knowledge about that world. Okay. So none knocks out the other. None can be reduced to the other. Having said that, he did feel that religion is the superior form of knowledge. Okay. Because religion refers to the ultimate. It refers to a part of the world that science and philosophy can never get to. part of the world, part of experience, okay? You existing in the here and now, okay? Qua here and now, as the here and now. Science and philosophy cannot get to there, okay? And religion can, okay? The knowledge of religion, the ultimate kind of certainty of religion can. And the idea is that we could conceivably live without science and philosophy, as in this strict kind of reasoning, logic, whatever, okay? You know, most of human history has been like that. We haven't had science and philosophy. That doesn't mean that we should get rid of that, okay? But the point is humans have been able to live without them. But religious knowledge is something we will always crave, okay? If we're denied or reject or you know, negate our religious knowledge, we will be lacking something, okay? It's not like not having scientific knowledge. It's generally a knowledge that if you don't have, there will be something seriously lacking in your life. Okay. In terms of the historical context, as I was saying, he was coming of age Meiji Japan was modernizing quite fast. There was this new faith in positivism, like Fukuzawa Yukichi was the most prominent philosopher at the time. An avowed positivist, saying that Japan has to be has to embrace Western rationality, Western science, you know, and get rid of all these older kind of schools of knowledge, okay, like Confucianism, Buddhism, whatever, that holds Japan back. Okay, the West as well was experiencing triumphalism of science, okay? Evolution, of course, was coming to the fore. So there was this sense that, you know, science is king, science is the master of knowledge, and religion's going to go downhill. Religion's going to decline and be seen as superstition and eventually humans will outgrow it. So he was responding to that, and he did acknowledge that, you know, religion can't go against science, okay? We can't, if it's science versus superstition, science has to win, okay? He feels that religion must always respect science, not try to argue against it, but just simply point out that science can't explain everything. And that bits that it can't explain, that's where you're going to be finding the religion, okay? Not as kind of a gap of the gods, as in, well, we can't explain it, so let's just assume it's religion. No, that there is this genuine knowledge there, okay? It's not superstition, it's not made up, it's not fanciful hope, that it is genuine, something you can know, okay? Okay. That's what I would say. Yeah.
That's such an interesting view, and I feel like a lot of modern day people could actually benefit from thinking in that way. So this, despite all these controversies around his work and his major role in the promotion of Zen Buddhism, how do you think we should use Suzuki's work nowadays, especially in teaching? So since this series is designed to be used as textbooks in the classroom, but we're also facing this situation that Japanese philosophy is so seldom taught or taken seriously in the teaching of philosophy, especially the majority of works out there and teaching contents are about Western philosophy. So how do you think Suzuki's philosophy can fit into this, and how can it be used in the teaching of Japanese history or Japanese culture?
Yes. First of all, like Suzuki, he gave a very accessible introduction to people, to Westerners for many decades, to the whole broad scope of Asian philosophy and Japanese philosophy. And I still think he plays that role, okay? Of course, there is a lot more knowledge about the more general Kyoto school of Nishida and so on, but still Suzuki is a good gateway into these other philosophers, other Kyoto school philosophers. Okay, you very rarely get such a thorough energetic explanation of just what's unusual and possibly different, or you know, worth noting in Japanese philosophy or you know, the Buddhist strand of Japanese philosophy. Sorry, just a second. The other thing is that Suzuki was constantly. He came of age, you know, when Western philosophy was prevalent in Japan. He was fully aware of it. And, you know, arguably he was educated in that as much as educated in the Buddhist tradition. So when he's talking about his Buddhist philosophy, he is constantly mindful of how it plays against or coheres with Western philosophy. There wasn't this compartmentalization where there's your Western philosophy over here, here's your Buddhism over there. He did try to separate it, but constantly he's still talking within a certain broad philosophical discourse that can include both Western and Buddhist philosophy. So I think there is that important lesson as well, that it's not when you go into Japanese philosophy or Japanese Buddhist philosophy, you're not jumping out of something, out of everything you've already known. Okay, there is already over there stuff that you've already known about, already learned, and probably already thought about before you even enter it. And I think that's a very important lesson as well. And let's say in terms of how he would be relevant today, as you were saying, first of all, his views on religion versus science are, you know, were quite maturely thought out and are still hugely relevant. You know, recently science has resurged again, scientism and you know, crude materialism, you know, and you know, Suzuki will always be quite an articulate counterpoint to that. Also, I think, you know, going back way back years ago when I first encountered Suzuki, what excited me about him was his philosophy of individualism. Okay, that no matter what system or society, whatever you're in, you still exist right now. It's not your, you know, it's not your completely your social identity that determines you. Like Lin Zai, the great Chinese philosopher of Zen way back in the Tang Dynasty, says that he talks about the as Suzuki would translate it, the man of no rank, okay, the human of no status, okay, that behind your flesh of blood, you know, you are there, okay, regardless of what social identities you're getting, okay. I think that's an extremely important point for nowadays, because you know the fashion nowadays is to go on and on about our identities, okay. And he's a reminder that behind all that, you still exist in the here and now, and that's where you start from and end with, and that can't be, you know, explained away or reduced out of the picture. And I think that's an important message as well he has for us.
That's absolutely great. I definitely agree. And I think from this conversation, I will probably have to change how I talk about Suzuki in my own dissertation. So I have you to thank for that. But no, thank you. Yeah, no, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. It was very enlightening.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for talking to me and your wonderful questions.
Yeah, and there's so much about D.T. Suzuki that we didn't get to cover in this chat.
Yes.
Yeah, so for our listeners, if you want to learn more about this legendary figure, make sure to check out this book, The Zen Buddhist Philosophy of D.T. Suzuki. This is Jin Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies, and I will see you soon.